trombone and also on shells. He is known as a musician who integrated shells, seashells, as musical instruments in his work. And it's quite a thrill listening to him. So he's on trombone, Kenny Garrett on alto and soprano sax, Sean Jones on trumpet and flugelhorn, Mulgrew Miller on piano, Peter Washington on bass, Ignacio Berroa on drums, and Pedro Martinez on percussion. And that is called Rainbow People. And I really like Steve Turi. I remembered seeing him for the first time on a New York subway system, and I went bonkers. People were trying to figure out what is wrong with that lady. Oh, well, you know, I was just very, very excited to see him. A very calm, low-key, confident musician, and just pushing the genre as far as he could go. It's wonderful to see him perform. All righty. So what are we talking about today? As you know, the trial, such as it is supposed to start in Georgia. The trial of the three white men who are accused of attacking and murdering Ahmaud Arbery. And what we're going to talk about is something that is usually not really discussed at length, but it is very important so that you understand that every case has a story of its own. Every case has a story to tell. And everybody, the prosecution, the defense, and even people accused, they go crazy trying to tailor a story. What is the narrative that they will use in this case? We will see what that narrative is, what they come up with to present to the court, meaning to the public. But we know enough to know that this case takes place in the crucible of race history in America. When we first learned about this case, it was about a young man, Ahmaud Arbery, 25 years old, who went for a jog, as he would routinely do. He was at home with his mother, and he decided he'll take a break and take a short jog, come back. Simply enough. But no, not in that part of the world. He sets out from his home in a community there, well-to-do community, but he sets out from his home and he courses his way through the neighborhood and is noticed. He is noticed by a white man who takes personal umbrage at the fact that this black man, he saw this black man running around in the neighborhood. He's not supposed to be running around. I mean, he didn't have papers. He didn't have a permission slip. He didn't get special permission to run in the predominantly white neighborhood. That part of the neighborhood was a predominantly white neighborhood. And so he calls up his buddy and pal, his neighbor, and the neighbor who used to work at the prosecutor's office alerts the neighbor, and the neighbor has a son who is also of the same mindset, you know, law enforcement mindset. And immediately they conjure up this in their heads, what is this black man doing here? Except, well, he's casing the joint. He's looking to steal something, or he's looking to do some kind of harm, but he's not supposed to be here. And so they organized themselves as a posse. Unknown to Ahmad, he's just jogging. And they set out after him in trucks. And they catch up with him. We don't know exactly what was said, what were the words traded between and among them, but we do know, because there is film footage, it was videotaped by a neighbor of the same mindset. And he thought, well, this is going down, I'll videotape it. And what we saw on the videotape was horrific. We saw Ahmad fighting literally for his life. And to the point where he tries to grab the gun away from the shotgun, by the way, away from one of the assailants. And he is shot. And he dies. Now, if you're covering this story, or if this story is supposed to mean anything to you, you can't just extract it from the history of the South. You can't do that. Because you would have missed the whole point that has to do with the power equation that has long been in existence. No matter who you are, no matter how many degrees you have, no matter what great job you have, you are subservient. You are inferior to anybody, practically, with a white skin who insists on affirming his or her rights of superiority. And that's exactly what happened. As far as these white men were concerned, this young black man had to account for himself to them first. They were judge and jury. And of what? He's just jogging. And he's murdered. And now the narrative shifts to the court. When the narrative shifts to the court, it becomes something completely different. If you excise, if you remove the history, it becomes, well, this person killed this person. And it's as straight and as clinical as that. But when you look at it in context, and when you look at it in terms of the ongoing history, not only of that area, but of the South in general, you get a whole different picture. An entirely different picture. And, by the way, that very thing is not going to be presented in a court of law. As far as the court is concerned, or the law is concerned, this is a murder. A bunch of white guys set upon this black man, and they kill him. And now that constitutes a charge of murder, and all the gears are supposed to be operating and functioning in that regard. But this is the story of an America that very few people want to believe still exists. It's an old story that talks about the value of black life and the power and authority of white life. It's a story that sees justice in those terms. In other words, it's very, very hard as a black person to be the beneficiary of a system that recognizes justice is justice, and justice is indeed blind. No, they don't recognize that. This is an old story of the South, an old story of the North and of the East and of the West, an old story. This is an American story. They could cover it up all they want and talk about, well, this is now a legal matter. You could say that if you want, if it makes you feel better. But I am cautioning people to remember where this comes from. The origination of this way of thinking is still with us today. And in many parts of the United States, it remains exactly the same as it was many, many years ago, centuries ago. It's the same thing. In fact, the only improvement might be that there's actually a trial so that the public can see what's going on in the court. But this fight is outside of the court. Everybody knows that. This hinges onto values that were implanted in people's heads a long time ago. Today, they explain it that it is, quote, the law, unquote. And we're going to court, giving it a semblance of legality. And hopefully justice will prevail. We don't even know what justice is in this case. We don't know. We do know what three white men decided what justice should be, and they saw to it on their own. Justice is whatever it is they think applies, and it applies without them having any sanctions against them. They're free to determine on an as-needed basis, a case-by-case basis, what justice is. Justice, in this case, to be very simple about it, justice, as they say in the South, he needed killing. He was killed because he needed killing. That's a simple formula, but it has remained intact for all these centuries. And we have a major effort mounted by the so-called Society of the South to convince people they've gone beyond that now. They've humanized themselves. They are agreeing to obey the law. You can't go around shooting people and killing people in the street, because you adjudged them to be guilty of something. So the case, in a way, returns us. It returns us if we are paying attention and if we allow ourselves to be educated in the moment. It returns us to this long-standing version of justice in America. Yes, now there's a trial and there's a courtroom and so forth, but keep in mind, they can't seat a jury yet. They can't find people to sit on a jury and actually begin this case, actually begin this trial. It is said that they sent out almost 1,000 notices that people should report for jury duty. And presumably, out of the people reporting for jury duty, they narrow it down, and then you get your jury that hears the case. They haven't been able to get to first base. They don't have enough people to form a jury. So you tell me how far the South has come. It hasn't. And people who want to think so need to pay attention. They're not hiding anything. They're not disguising anything. This is just the way it's working out. And by law, they're following the rules. So we still have to ask the question then, why can't you seat a jury in a murder trial in this day and age if you've progressed so far? If racial hatred is not in your heart, why is it you can't get a jury to hear this case? And it's a murder trial. Does that not suggest that at a fundamental level, they refuse to leave the past? They refuse to actually obey the law. People are saying, I think I'll be in danger if I participate in this trial as a juror. I don't want to do that. I don't want harm to come to either myself or my family. And yet we're told how far people have come, especially the South. So they cannot yet seat a jury. So more than 1,000 notices were sent out to specific people, as is usually the case. When there's an important case, they send out these requests for your presence, and supposedly you would obey and show up to do your civic duty. So that's the first indication that the South, and particularly this part of the South, they don't care what you say. They have their own views. And those views are far more important than any law. What do you say about three white men confronting a young black man who's jogging and then produce a shotgun and blow him away in the street with confidence that nothing would happen to them. That's their law. They're following their law that has been on the books, if you will, for a very long time. We determine who is guilty. We determine who is innocent. We determine who gets killed. And we kill them. So, is this progress? And there's, who is advocating for this man, Ahmaud Arbery? Who's insisting that the law must be obeyed? Who is insisting that he had rights as well, and still does have rights as a victim of a summary execution in the street? People could find all kinds of reasons. Well, you know, these guys, I'm sure they didn't want to kill him like that. They didn't want to kill him like that. No, that's why they followed him as he was jogging and then confronted him at an intersection and blew him away. So to those who keep telling us about all the strides made, all the progress made, especially since the civil rights era, since it pointed out all these contradictions, and those contradictions were sincerely corrected, what do you say now? You can't even get a jury to listen to this case. And people are still running around confident in the American jurisprudence system, in the court system. You know, I listen to the double entendres that people use all the time, thinking they can't be spotted. But this is as basic as you can get in terms of how Americans define democracy and the value of their lives. And people are more worried about what's going to happen to the three men, including a father and son. The father had a previous working relationship. He worked in the district attorney's office. So you think of all the little twists and turns here, but the point of it is, for most people who understand that the issue is justice, there are no twists and turns. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. A young man, he had just told his mother he's going for a jog, he'll be back, and he never came back. And the people who allegedly killed him, those were the ones that the fingers are pointing to, are emboldened even more because white people in this community, in this area, and generally throughout the South, are very sympathetic to them. This is what they mean by people standing up against crime. Jogging is a crime. this young man was just jogging. And then we now have to ask ourselves, to what degree are we accountable for just being tourists in this experience? Are we involved? Are we advocating? Are we outraged? No, more and more we see evidence of a kind of reticence with us. We are unwilling. In fact, in some cases, we're downright terrified to take a position, a principled position, mind you. And to my mind, this place, this entire country, should resonate on the basis of what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. Nobody should be untouched. Everybody should be very, very upset and involved. But we too, the black community, people of color, they've gone through changes themselves. I have enough stuff to think about for myself. I have my family to think about. I have me to think about. I can't be bothered with that. I don't have time for that. But you will hear them talk about, you know, the need for people to be out in the street. Well, how do they get there unless they make up their minds to get there? And we're hearing about high-profile races that are about to be run. Without people making connections, you may be running in New York, but Ahmaud Arbery died in the southern version of New York. It's the same mentality. It's the same history. And it hasn't gone away. So I felt the need to say something, because we are told on the news and told so often that we are likely to accept it as fact, that there's nothing we can do. We just have to wait and see how the system deals with this thing, how it turns out. And that speaks to a degree of alienation on our part that is practically historic. We used to feel very concerned about these things. Now that work is left up to a chosen few who say they're taking time off of work, or they retired and they have the time to devote to demonstrating. But we don't see it as a problem for us. That is happening over there, to those people over there. It has no connection to me. So we have to start looking at that. Looking at that right now, that's what we've got to do. Because it means that we have come full circle. We are so distant from ourselves. It doesn't matter whether you're white, black, Latino, Asian, what. This is not supposed to be happening on your watch. And you have to say something. You have to do something. This is not the way we're supposed to be living. And this is certainly not the way we're supposed to be dying. And when you take the temperature of America, people just kind of, well, you know, this has been going on for a long time, so we are anesthetized. We have no particular feeling of outrage about it anymore. I caution us all that the next victims could be ourselves. I'll take this break and come back to your questions and comments at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we're talking about our distorted view of how much progress we have made when every day practically we see and hear about or read about testimonies that tell us differently. And still we persist with this idea, a naive idea, that progress is being made. I don't know what kind of progress you're talking about, but I do know that most communities that still understand who they are would never put up with this. Never. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you have to say. 888-874-4888. Joe from Florida, you start us off today.
Give my call. Let me start out by saying that you haven't lived until you've had a loaded gun pointed at your head, which I've had that happen to me twice. One time, there were two people involved. One had the gun pointed at me, and the other was just standing next to him. And I had experience in the Marine Corps. I had to take a gun away from somebody, and I know how to do it. Unfortunately, there were another person there, and I couldn't do it because if you take the gun away from one, the other guy can still shoot you. Okay? So this is the problem. That, of course, that gentleman never should have been stopped, let alone had a gun pointed at him. But he, you know, he made a mistake of grabbing the rifle. And that would have been fine if there were no one else around. I don't say that it precipitated his death. And I'm not justifying it. Don't misconstrue what I'm saying. But if you, I hope you understand what I just said. That if he had not grabbed the gun, he probably wouldn't have gotten shot. And it was a mistake that he made that I wouldn't make if somebody has a gun pointed at me. If there's another person there.
Yes, but you're talking about this in terms of mistakes. The man saw, he felt, Ahmaud Arbery. He felt that his life was going to be ending soon. He was desperate to live.
Well,
and he made an attempt.
Latrice, I had the same experience. I don't know.
Yeah, but you're two different people.
Pardon?
You're two different people. This is the way... In that moment, his everything in him said, do whatever you have to do to just get out of here and survive.
And I had the same situation. Yeah, I was but in the same.
You can't make a judgment based on how you would respond or how you did respond, and
I didn't
how
get
Ahmaud
killed.
Aubrey responded.
I didn't get killed.
And yes, you didn't get killed,
that was your luck.
But in this, you notice that the people who were there, as I mentioned, had an affiliation with the prosecutor's office and still let it happen.
Let what happen?
And father and son were there together in this.
I'm very familiar with the case. I followed it right from the get-go. And it's sickening what happened. There's no question about it. But I was in a similar position where somebody had
that is you. I keep saying you were in a similar situation.
That's right, and
so everybody is supposed to act like you acted?
He should have, but he didn't know any better.
You don't understand how human nature works. You don't get it. People,
I most certainly
the
do.
The thing is, he was at that moment. What mattered to him was just to get out of there alive by any means necessary, and that's what he felt he needed to do. And he did it.
I felt the same way, Latrice. I felt the same way. As I said before,
I don't want you to set up a parallel because there's no parallel between your case and this case.
It most certainly is. You haven't lived until you had a gun pointed at your head. Maybe then you would understand what I'm talking about.
Well, that's facetious
and
insulting to say that I would not understand. I cannot understand the enormity of the situation because I have not had a gun pointed to my head. That's just nonsense.
That happened 10 years ago.
No. You're not going to tell me the fallout. I'm still stuck with the fact that you can hold on as tenaciously as you have to these false notions that you have. You're completely off base. The fact is, and I think you can agree, all right, thank you. People cannot, they have to find a reason to justify the killing of this man when it's so clear there was no reason for him to be shot in the street and by people who should know better. These were people in the criminal justice system working for the prosecutor. But he has his son there, and they both participated in the killing of Ahmaud Aubrey. So, I'm not getting clinical about it. This is not a time to be clinical. He was fighting for his life the best way he knew how, and he had no help. No help, not even from the people who worked for the prosecutor's office. No help. So he tried to hold on to the barrel of the gun and was overwhelmed. It was three of them, one of him. So I don't understand the need to continue to blame people like this. And the situation is as clear as day to see. It did not have to happen. And they chased him down. He's trying to just get a little job going. And they are in trucks, like they're hunting for a gazelle or something. These people are animals. Animals. I don't want to insult animals because animals would have had a reason. They didn't, except that they felt they had the power to dispatch a human being, a black human being, because he was worth nothing and he presented no threat to them because they knew people, they had good jobs in the prosecutor's office, et cetera, et cetera. Joe, no, Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Latrice?
Okay, how are you?
I'm here. You know, I totally agree with you insofar as these men felt they had the right to institute vigilante justice. And the sad part about it is that this is part and parcel of the American experience. It's part and parcel of being white in America. You feel the right that you can go, if you see somebody running or a stranger in your neighborhood, you feel the right to go get your gun, hop in your truck, and put a hole in the man's chest. And it's sad that this country has not come to terms with his history of race, with his history of white privilege, with his history of persecution, and it never will. We've even got the other case with the Kyle, I can't remember the kid's name, the 17-year-old kid that killed three protesters. I think his name is Kyle, something or other. And his case, Kyle Rittenhouse, and his case is coming to trial. And they've already stipulated that you cannot call the three people that he killed victims. You can call them looters. You can call them rioters.
Rioters. Yes.
You can't call them victims. But what kind of ridiculous thing is that? Because it's going to prejudice the jury. I mean, the further we go in this country, the far back we go. And you know, I mean, that's why I'm like Stevie Wonder. I really want to leave this country because it's not getting better. It's getting worse. And people are not getting outraged about this. They're not clamoring in the streets and forcing these people to recognize that we are human beings. You know, it's a travesty.
What does it say that in a trial that should be so important that you can't get a full jury to sit and hear this trial?
Well, this goes to show it's the mentality of those people in that part of the country. It's the mentality of the people in the South. Florida, Texas, Alabama, all of it, that is ingrained in their heritage. It is part of the lifestyle of that mindset in this part of the nation, and it's never been broken. And I don't think it ever will be broken. I think that
thanks
that
for your call.
This country.
Thank you very much for your call. Marcus from Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Yeah. Yes, thank you very much, Utrice, for letting me take part in this discussion. I'll be brief. Ed is absolutely correct. It's a mentality, but the mentality didn't just come out of the sky. There is, over many years, I have made a study of white violence, and in fact, white Americans from the very beginning, going back to the 1600s in this country, invented the concept of the vigilante. And there was actually a series of doctrines behind it. You know, there have been three major periods in American history, major phases of black-white violence that really stand out. There's the initial sporadic black revolts against slavery during the period of slavery, white violence, and amazingly so, because their numerical disadvantage was enormous, the fact that these revolts happened at all. Second was, after the establishment of the Emancipation Proclamation, after the Civil War, white supremacy became really difficult to uphold. So they actually had to invent, in this middle term, a long-term rationale for maintaining white violence, even riots and lynching, carried out to maintain it. And this doctrine still survives. The most recent phase of black-white violence is the 1960s cycle of massive ghetto riots in reaction to white violence and the deprivations suffered by blacks in the United States, mainly in the cities. Now, I have before me a short paragraph. There were, long before the mass importation of slaves to the United States, black slaves, there was already a long tradition of white vigilantism against, and it was based on this idea. This is a brief excerpt from the 1858 resolution of Northern Indiana vigilantes. Almost every state had regulators and organized vigilantes. The Ku Klux Klan came later. They said, "We are believers in the doctrine of popular sovereignty, that the people of this country are the real sovereigns, and that whenever the laws made by those to whom they have delegated their authority are found inadequate to their protection, it is the right of the people to take the protection of their property into their own hands and deal with these villains according to their just deserts." Now, this still survives in the United States. This doctrine among whites still survives. It is not articulated as a doctrine anymore, but it is passed along culturally, almost unspoken. So the fact of the way the white people behaved, these whites behaved against Ahmaud Arbery, is just a continuation of a long, long, long American tradition among whites. And it's white people do not accept it. They don't. They aren't aware of it, but it's absolutely there. It's almost completely unstudied in the annals of American violence. But this is not accidental. These are not people motivated by personal reasons. There's a cultural justification for this to these people, as insane as it is. It's based completely on myths from the post-Civil War reconstruction of, the black brute
remind people that one of the assailants was a person who worked in the law enforcement community.
This is why the courts are still so lenient about it, because in the southern states especially, this doctrine of natural law is actually, if you read the statutes, it's actually inspiring statutes in the formation of the laws of these states. It's no accident. There are historical reasons for this. They're lousy.
Oh, yes,
reasons,
I know.
There.
But I'm saying, when we yield to things that we don't understand, mm-hmm. it simply is a perpetuation of what we experienced before, and it dismisses the tremendous pain and suffering that had gone on before, illegally as well. So mm-hmm. we have to remember that two of the assailants were said to have been affiliated with the prosecutor's office.
This is not uncommon. Not at all.
Not uncommon. You're right. Thank you so much for your call today.
Thank you.
Positive, you're on the air. You know, I like people to give their real names. Why do you give yourself another name?
Well, Latrice Lee, with all due respect, you met me before back in the days. I was given the name Positive in 1977 or 78. So that is my name.
Oh, okay.
There's actually more to it than that, but I choose to just tell you my first name as opposed to tell you my old name. That is my name.
Okay.
I first like to say to the caller from Florida, I don't know his name, but he showed no humility and a lot of idiocy making a statement that you haven't lived or lived until you have a gun in your at your head or pointed at you, or you know, fearful to the edge of your life. That's stupid. That's dumb. I'm speaking one who had a gun put in his mouth by the New York City police. So I know that's idiocy to make a stupid statement like that. So that bothered me to the core, you know. I wasn't going to say anything, I mean, calling or nothing like that, but only listen to the callers that, you know, had called in before. You know, you and I and others have experienced lots of racism in this country. And what I saw happen, or what is going on to this day, is an example of that. We have to understand that a lot of us, sad to say, don't care about us. And to see young white people today take up the mantle and say Black Lives Matter is a good thing, as well as some of us upholding it as well. But a lot of us don't care. We don't matter to us anymore. We're too busy trying to be matriculated into the mainstream of society and be like anybody but us. We don't care about us anymore. We don't. You know, we really don't. So a lot of things you said was right and exact, and I stand behind you with that. I just wanted you to know that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for giving me that explanation. Thank you. Adele from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. Your commentary is always very measured and very carefully delivered. I appreciate that. You know, many talk show hosts, they speak with bullet points, but you always give your points in a very comprehensive way. I appreciate that, you know.
Thank you.
Very thoughtful, very thoughtful. But I would like to say that we have to look at our condition in a historical sense also. The fact is, human beings at large, across every spectrum, are not as evolved as we would like to believe. If you look at old Rome, I mean, I've traveled and seen the ruins and the story. I read extensively ancient history, you know? You know what I mean? And
yes.
First of all, the plight of women as women, the genocide against women is nearly completely unnoticed. It goes without, I mean, women are just...
I have to interrupt you and ask you a huge favor.
Yes.
We're out of time, but I don't want to interrupt and cut off your presentation. So could you return tomorrow and just give us the full thing?
Thank you, sweetheart. You are so, so beautiful. I appreciate you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we've cut a deal.
Okay, thank you.
We're out of time.
Okay.
And it is important to me. I love the idea of people having the time to express themselves, because that's, to me, a vital part of the purpose of the program. So thank you so much for listening today and contributing today. And we will continue this discussion tomorrow. Bye-bye.